Chapter 7. Misogyny in the Age of Supermen. When what we call history is actually being lived, there is rarely a neat dividing line between one epoch and another. We decisively separate our modern world from that of the Victorians, especially in sexual matters, forgetting that it was men rooted in the Victorian age who helped shape the 20th century and how it would view and treat women. Sigmund Freud, 1856 to 1939, Charles Darwin, 1809 to 1882, and Karl Marx, 1818 to 1883, were 19th century men who bequeathed us ideas, the consequences of which were only fully realized in the century following it. The ideas of all three have had a sometimes profound bearing on the history of misogyny. With Marx and Darwin, the influence is not at first immediately obvious, but with Freud, it most certainly is. By the beginning of the 20th century, the ideals of the Enlightenment, with their emphasis on the individual's equality and autonomy, seemed secure throughout Western Europe, the United States, and in nations that were their offshoots. Linked to these was the idea of progress, also firmly embedded in the West. It seemed far more than merely an idea. It seemed a reality. A period of unparalleled industrial growth and economic expansion held out the promise of widespread prosperity. In Europe and North America, in states where democratic forms of government prevailed, women's rights were firmly on the political agenda, among them the right to vote. In 1893, New Zealand had become the first nation-state to grant suffrage to women. Denmark, Finland, Iceland, and Norway followed. The Bolshevik Revolution in Russia gave them that right in 1917. The next year, after a long and at times bitter campaign lasting the best part of a century, the United Kingdom granted women over 30 the right to vote, and 10 years later dropped the voting age to 21. The right to vote became the 19th Amendment to the US Constitution in August 1920. Meanwhile, women were an increasingly important part of the workforce. The public sphere was no longer an all-male preserve. Middle-class women had access to higher education and were entering professions hitherto thought of as for men only. Not for the first time in the history of misogyny, women's progress provoked a reaction. It manifested itself at several different levels: scientific, philosophical, and political. But if these reactions had a shared aim, it was to demonstrate that men's contempt for women was justified. The ancient prejudice had to be reconfirmed, if not reinforced, to reassure men that regardless of equality and women's rights, certain aspects in the male-female relationship would never change. This emerges starkly enough in the work of Freud. He has been extraordinarily influential, so much so that in the words of the English poet W. H. Auden, he became a whole climate of opinion under whom we conduct our different lives. His work represents the first extensive and detailed scientific examination of the psychological differences between the sexes. Freud attempted to find the psychoanalytical roots in the perceived differences in the nature of men and women. In his early years, he tended to stress the parallels between the development of boys and girls rather than the differences. At one point, he even entertained the notion that boys experienced womb envy. However, as he grew older, he developed a more dualistic view. It was during this period, in the 1920s, that his more famous formulations about men and women were pronounced. When probed, some of these findings turn out to resemble those held by African witch doctors. That the witch doctor makes his pronouncements dressed up in the shiny new white coat of science cannot disguise their remarkable similarities. Witness Freud's attack on the clitoris. In a paper written in 1925, he saw the clitoris as the masculine element of female sexuality since it has erections, and the masturbation of the clitoris as a masculine activity. He claimed, "The elimination of clitoridal sexuality is a necessary precondition for the development of femininity. Femininity is achieved through a sort of regime change, with the clitoris handing over its sensitivity and at the same time its importance to the vagina." The Dogon tribe of Niger in West Africa believes that each person is born with a male and female soul. For girls to realize their true femaleness, it is necessary to remove that part of them where their male soul resides, i.e. the clitoris, just as boys must undergo circumcision to remove their female soul hiding in their foreskin. As we have seen, some Victorian medical experts advocated clitoridectomy to cure female diseases. What is the difference between a quaint old African myth, Victorian clitoridectomy, and the assertions of Sigmund Freud, other than that Freud proposes a psychic instead of a physical mutilation of the woman? He claims that true femininity comes about when the woman foregoes the sexual pleasure derived from masculine activity, which is identified with the clitoris because it is the source of a pure pleasure unrelated to reproduction. Such selfishness is characteristic of the male, and therefore has to be abandoned if the female is to become fully a feminine creature, since femininity implies self-abrogation and self-denial for a higher purpose, which is identified with the vagina. And what, may we ask, could possibly inspire a girl to forego her clitoral delights? Girls, writes Freud, notice the penis of a brother or playmate, strikingly visible and of larger proportions, at once recognize it as the superior counterpart to their own small and inconspicuous organ, and from that time forward fall a victim to envy for the penis. Clearly, for Freud at least, size matters. It also determines how men see women and offers an explanation for misogyny. This combination of circumstances leads to two reactions, which may become fixed and will, with other factors, permanently determine the boy's relations to women: horror of the mutilated creature or triumphant contempt for her. According to Freud, this explains not only why men hold women in contempt, but also why women themselves develop contempt for a sex which is the lesser in so important a respect. This theory therefore predicts that misogyny is not an aberration, but in fact a normal, universal reaction on the part of both men and women to the mutilated female. Freud's description of female development echoes not only that of African witch doctors, but also the views of Aristotle. Some 2,200 years earlier, Aristotle also saw females as mutilated males, creatures that failed to realize their full potential. Like Aristotle, Freud's starting point is to assume that the male is the sexual norm against which the other is measured. This establishes a kind of duality, male normality versus female abnormality, that deepens in his thought as time passes. He uses it in the end to repeat many of the old misogynistic prejudices against women, except that this time they are justified in the name of science. His theory that femininity depended on a transfer of focus from clitoral to vaginal sex could be seen as the scientific justification for the prejudice, expounded most vociferously in contemporary Nazi propaganda, that women's role should be confined to being mothers. By the time he had come to write one of his last works, Civilization and Its Discontents, in 1929, men were equated with civilization itself and women with its opponents, a hostile, resentful, and conservative force driven by penis envy. His conclusion was that female sexuality was a dark continent, a revealing metaphor that places women alongside Africans firmly outside the realm of civilization, which is the business of men. Freud admitted in Some Psychical Consequences that his theories of female sexuality were based on a handful of cases. Erecting big theories on small data is not good scientific practice. Science is one of those areas where size, of the sample of facts upon which theories are based, does matter. Freud's willingness to advance his views, despite lack of sufficient evidence, says more about the size of his own ego than about the nature of female sexuality. "I always find it uncanny," he wrote, "when I can't understand someone in terms of myself." Remarks like this have led some to put him in the tradition of the supermen of Nietzsche, those self-reverential monsters before whose great male egos all else pales into insignificance. Certainly, Freud's dualistic view of the sexes fits very well into that tradition, though it is not derived from the same irrational, romantic tenets. Nietzsche saw woman as the enemy of truth, whereas Freud saw her as the enemy of civilization. The Nietzschean tradition of the essential dualism of male and female provided one of the chief bases for the philosophical and later the political backlash against women in the 20th century. In the autumn of 1901, Freud made the acquaintance of one of its lesser-known but nonetheless significant exponents. A 21-year-old graduate from the University of Vienna, called Otto Weininger, approached him with the outline of a book he planned to write, entitled Sex and Character. Freud read the outline and was unimpressed, remarking, ironically enough, considering his own habit of making do with small data, "The world wants evidence, not thoughts." He told the young man to spend 10 years gathering evidence for his theories. Such an undertaking was alien to Weininger's nature. In any case, he did not have that long left to live. Otto Weininger, 1880 to 1903, was by all accounts a brilliant student who by the age of 18 could speak 8 languages. He was deeply influenced in his thinking by Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. That is, he inherited a tradition deeply hostile to women and brought it to its philosophical climax in Sex and Character, published in 1903. In it, his misogynistic dualism takes on an almost mystical quality. Every positive achievement in civilization is associated with men, Aryan men. Women are its negation. Weininger goes to the extreme of denying women their humanity and reduces them to non-entities. Women have no existence and no essence. They are not. They are nothing. He invokes the Platonic distinction between matter and form, between the mutable, transient world of the senses and the ideal. Woman is matter and man is form. Claiming that woman has no essence means that she does not exist at the highest level of pure form, and therefore, for Weininger, her actual material existence is of no consequence. Weininger repeats the fall of man myth at a philosophical level. For matter is in itself nothing. It can only come into existence through form, that is, through desiring a woman who is the material on which man acts. She is sexuality itself. According to Weininger, the dualism of the world is beyond comprehension. It is the plot of man's fall, the primitive riddle. It is the binding of eternal life on a perishable being, of the innocent in the guilty. Plato, Genesis, and the doctrine of original sin are combined in Weininger's thought as woman binds man into perishable matter and the eternal form degenerates into the transient world. He concludes that as the instrument that brings about this fall, woman alone, then, is guilt. Weininger was Jewish, but his anti-Semitism is as much a characteristic of his work as is his misogyny, though he dissociates himself from anything as vulgar as advocating persecution, practical or theoretical, of the Jews. He draws parallels between women and Jews. Like women, Jews are without any trace of genius. Jews and women are similar in their extreme adaptability and their lack of deeply rooted original ideas. In fact, the mode in which, like women, they are nothing in themselves, they can become everything. Both, too, are double-minded, never truly believing in anything, and therefore entirely untrustworthy. Not surprisingly, Weininger also regards the empiricists as contemptible. No true Aryan, he asserts, would build a system of thought based on anything so superficial as the evidence of the senses or the need to validate theories by experiment. He despises the English because of their reliance on empirical thought, which he scorns as shallow. The ultimate aim of Sex and Character, as stated by the author at the beginning of the book, is to deal with the question of woman's emancipation, which fills him with anxiety, since he views it as a threat to the concept of humanity. He returns to the question in his conclusion and laments the fact that New Zealand has granted women the right to vote, putting it on a par with enfranchising imbeciles, children, and criminals. He relates emancipation to prostitution and the Jews' pernicious influence. Not surprisingly, he arrives at a position similar to that of the Christian ascetics of the 4th century and concludes, "Coitus is immoral." Not long after Sex and Character was published in 1903, Otto Weininger committed suicide. The book had generally received scant or unfavourable attention. But the young man's death cast a tragic aura over him and his work, and his ideas soon took on the status of a cult in Viennese circles, where, according to sexologist Ivan Bloch, even heterosexual men began to renounce women in horror. His impact spread to France, Germany, England, and America, where his work was hailed by the prestigious literary critic Ford Madox Ford, who declared that a new gospel had appeared among men. Weininger influenced such thinkers as the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, also a Viennese, and has more lately impressed a handful of feminists. Germaine Greer praises his work in The Female Eunuch, arguing that his theories of women were merely based on what he saw around him. In this, she carries on a long tradition within feminist thought that shares some of the assumptions of traditional misogyny, including contempt for aspects of the feminine, such as concern for beauty. However, his true significance in the history of misogyny is found elsewhere. At the level of ideas, he vividly and powerfully crystallizes the main currents of contempt for women flowing from traditional Judeo-Christian and Greek philosophical thought. More importantly, he is the expression of a worldview that is both anti-Semitic and misogynist, which found a powerful resonance in another young man who haunted the cafes and streets of turn-of-the-century Vienna and absorbed its fetid atmosphere of prejudice and hatred, Adolf Hitler, 1889 to 1945. There are remarkable similarities not only in the thought, but also in aspects of the lives of Hitler and the three philosophers Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, and Weininger. All were alienated, sexually insecure men who, as far as is known, never formed mature, stable relationships with women or enjoyed steady home lives. Their sense of isolation was accompanied by an overwhelming belief in their own destiny. When Weininger declared after his book was published, "There are three possibilities for me, the gallows, suicide, or a future so brilliant that I don't dare think of it," Hitler would have understood. Their misogyny, based on fear of women, and perhaps of an underlying fear of intimacy itself, was also linked to other prejudices, especially anti-Semitism. To paraphrase Hamlet, rarely do prejudices come as single spies, but rather in battalions. The atmosphere of Vienna at the turn of the last century was poisonously anti-Semitic. In the mind of Weininger, women's emancipation, prostitution, and Jews were all linked. He writes that what the women's movement is about is merely the desire to be free, to shake off the trammels of motherhood. As a whole, the practical results show that it is a revolt from motherhood towards prostitution, a prostitute emancipation, rather than the emancipation of womanhood as a whole is aimed at. He claims that it is only because of the cunning influence of the Jews that we bow before it and see it as other than it really is. Hitler echoed these ideas, denouncing women's rights as a phrase invented by the Jewish intellect. In his warped vision, Jews, prostitutes, Marxists, and modern women were part of a sinister plot against motherhood and Teutonic civilization. Hitler arrived in Vienna in 1908 as a 19-year-old aspiring artist, but failed in his attempt to gain entrance to the Academy of Fine Arts. In his ample spare time, he used to lecture his friend August Kubizek, with whom he for a time shared a room, on the evils of prostitution. Occasionally he took Kubizek on tours of the city's red light district, which inspired further rants about sex and moral decadence. Later, he would blame the Jews for the spread of prostitution, as well as for the spread of liberal ideas. He once launched into a furious diatribe when Kubizek, who was studying piano, brought a woman home to give her piano lessons. He told his friend women were incapable of benefiting from such learning. Like Weininger, Hitler advocated abstinence from sex, as from alcohol and meat. He was also against masturbation. Another friend said of him that he had very little respect for the female sex, but very austere ideas about the relations between men and women. His ideal woman was, in his own words, a cute, cuddly, naive little thing, tender, sweet, and stupid. All sorts of mostly lurid rumours have accumulated over the years about Hitler's sexuality. He He obsessed about women, Jews, and syphilis in his autobiography, Mein Kampf, and 5 of the 6 women with whom he had any kind of relationship committed suicide, including his 23-year-old niece, Geli Rabal, about whom he was pathologically jealous. "My uncle is a monster," she once said. In September 1931, she was found dead in his Munich apartment, shot in the head with his pistol. He was almost certainly asexual, and while he seems to have derived some pleasure from the company of pretty young women, his behaviour indicates a tremendous fear of women in general. He liked to refer to the malleability of the masses as feminine, showing his contempt for both the mobs that he roused with his speeches and women with whom he compared them. Tragically, he would leave the bloody stamp of his obsessions, misogynistic as well as racial, on the history of the 20th century. With the rise of the National Socialist movement, out of which the Nazis sprang, Hitler went from being a vagrant with fanatical ideas to a charismatic leader with the power to turn them into political reality in all their murderous horror. From the beginning, the Nazi Party was a powerful engine of misogyny as well as of racial hatred. It came out of the all-male culture of the trenches, beer halls, the paramilitary organizations, and ex-servicemen's associations set up by former German soldiers, embittered and angry at Germany's defeat in the First World War. There was also a distinct homosexual trait running through the Nazi cult of the warrior and Superman. This became especially noticeable in the Nazi Party's original paramilitary organization, the SA. Hitler's own contempt for women fitted well with the fledgling party's prevailing attitude. At the very first general meeting of the National Socialist German Workers' Party in 1921, party members passed a unanimous resolution that a woman can never be accepted into the leadership of the party and into the governing committee. More broadly, Nazism's misogyny was one expression of a deep-seated paradox that it shares with many fundamentalist and conservative movements, including those that Islam, Christianity, and Orthodox Judaism have more recently produced. While exploiting technological progress, without which it could not fight its wars or maintain its dominance, at the same time, National Socialism remained fiercely hostile to modernity. To the Nazis, no more blatant and worrying expression of modernity could be found than the emancipated woman of the 1920s with her high heels, lipstick and cigarettes. Between the years 1918 and 1933, Germany had developed a modern hedonistic culture where nightclubs flourished, Hollywood movies were the rage, and sexual experimentation was rife. The Nazis' rigid exclusion of women from its power structures, and their long-term goal to remove them altogether from public life, did not prevent women from supporting the up-and-coming agitator. As Hitler himself recognized, women had played not an insignificant part in his political career. A few even worshipped him as a new messiah. In some ways, the National Socialist line followed the same theme of Kinder, Küche, Kirche, children, kitchen, and church, that the other conservative parties extolled. At first, German women gave their support to these more traditional right-wing parties. But in the election of November 1932, women voted Nazi in as large numbers as did men. Given what happened later, it is surely one of the great ironies that women proved so crucial to Hitler's success. However, it is hardly surprising that in an age of uncertainty, rapid change, and threatened communist revolution, Hitler's message was for many German women reassuring in its emphasis on the timeless values of home and family. As one sentimental Nazi poem expressed it, "Mothers, your cradles are like a slumbering army, ever ready for victory. They will never be empty." Most women probably did not take the militarization of motherhood seriously, or see its sinister metaphor directly linking the cradle to war as a prediction of what was to come. But Hitler took it very seriously. German women were an essential part of his war machine's production line. However, Nazi propaganda managed to disguise the brutal reality as it conjured up an Arcadian vision of lost innocence, a time when the world was a simpler place and women were purer, content to be mothers, without perverse social or political ambitions. Two of the party's most notorious misogynists, Julius Streicher and Ernest Röhm, chief of the SA, helped propagate a cloyingly sentimental vision of German motherhood. Not surprisingly, both men were fixated upon their mothers. Streicher edited the lurid weekly Der Stürmer, which at its height had a circulation of nearly 1 million. It combined anti-Semitism with violent pornographic depictions of helpless German maidens being raped by demon-like Jews. Streicher's excesses embarrassed even some Nazis, who wanted Der Stürmer suppressed. But Hitler tolerated Streicher and his obsessions, perhaps because they resembled one of the Führer's own recurring nightmares, a naked German woman, chained and helpless, as a Jewish butcher creeps up upon her from the rear, and a watching Hitler is unable to save her. Streicher furiously protested in 1923 that the French army that occupied the Rhine in the post-war settlement employed black soldiers. He wrote, "When a Negro soldier on the Rhine misuses a German girl, she is lost to the race forever." He also believed that a single act of intercourse between a Jew and a German woman would prevent her from ever having a pure-blooded Aryan child, and campaigned, successfully, to have marriages between the races outlawed. Misogynistic cultures dwell on such fantasies of rape or seduction of their women by alien forms. In the phantasmagorical minds of Nazi and Inquisitor, the demon Jew played the same perverse role to the purebred Aryan maiden as the incubus did to the witch. It repeats a common misogynistic obsession, linking something seen as crucial to male security, such as honour, to a woman's virtue. In Nazi ideology, preserving the German woman's virtue was identified with preserving racial purity. Frighteningly, this pathology became a social policy. The Nazis passed laws forbidding German women to have sex with the lesser races, such as Jews or Slavs. During the war, in the absence of German men, thousands of Poles were employed to work on farms to help the lonely and no doubt often frustrated German wives and widows. From denunciations made to the German secret police, the Gestapo, it appears that even in cases where a German woman was raped at the hands of a Polish worker, she was publicly punished. Her head was shaven and she was pilloried. The men were hanged, whether the relationship was consensual or not. In contrast, when German men slept with Polish women, the Gestapo merely noted it. Hitler saw the problem of women's position in modern society as a direct result of the stupid notion of the equality of the sexes. Modern women were held to be responsible for the twilight of the family. They were guilty of treason against nature for not having children. "But German men want German women again," declared a National Socialist pamphlet. "Not a frivolous plaything who is superficial and only out for pleasure, who decks herself with tawdry finery and is like a glittering exterior that is hollow and drab within. Our opponents sought to bend women to their dark purposes by painting frivolous life in the most glowing colours and portraying the true profession allotted to women by nature as slavery." The true German woman rejected lipstick, high heels, and nail varnish in favour of becoming a sort of primordial milkmaid, according to the ideal of party experts. They held that women will only be happy again when the natural differences between men and women are reinstated. Alfred Rosenberg, the party philosopher, claimed that women think lyrically, not systematically, as men do. One Nazi slogan declared, "Women must be emancipated from women's emancipation." Hitler promised to do away with the idea that what he does with his own body is each individual's own business. It was the state's business, and the state knew what it wanted to do with German women's bodies. Hitler declared, "If in the past the liberal intellectual women's movements contained in their programs many, many points arising out of the so-called mind, then the program of our National Socialist Women's Movement really only contains one single point, and that point is the child." His words echo Nietzsche's proclamation that the answer to the riddle of woman is pregnancy. Hitler reflects the mother fixation of those mystical misogynists Schopenhauer and Weininger. One of the practical consequences of this for German women was that in 1938, childlessness was restored in law as grounds for divorce. Abortion and contraceptives were also banned. In this case, at least, Hitler was on the pro-life side of the argument. The state awarded women a decoration, the Motherhood Cross Award, mimicking those given to men for courage in battle, according to their childbearing achievements. Hitler's vision of a post-war world included a law that would force every woman, single or married, under the age of 34, who had not already borne at least 4 children, to mate with a purebred German male. If he was already married, he would be set free for the purpose. According to Heinrich Himmler, the head of the elite SS troop, Nietzsche's Superman could be attained by means of breeding. Thus did the Nazis envision Germany's future as one vast stud farm that would supply Hitler's divisions with fresh cannon fodder. The racially pure studs were to be called conception assistants. But misogyny under the Nazis was unfortunately not confined to the familiar obsessions with German woman's virtue or to perpetuating sentimental, though self-serving, illusions about motherhood. No more horrifying contrast with these cloying fantasies could be found than in the murderous brutality meted out to Jewish women during the reign of the Third Reich. The Nazis placed all Jews outside any normal ethical code in their pursuit of the genocidal solution to the Jewish problem. Some scholars have objected that anti-Semitism did not distinguish its victims on gender lines. The Holocaust happened to victims who were not seen as men, women and children, but as Jews, wrote Cynthia Ozick. But as is nearly always the case, when persecution is inflicted upon any hated group, the women of that group are singled out for particular humiliations and cruelties. When racial or religious hatreds are let loose, the underlying misogyny is usually given free rein. When Hitler annexed Austria in March 1938 and the German army marched in, a series of brutal attacks were unleashed upon Austrian Jews. In a wealthy suburb of Vienna called Waring, the Nazis ordered Jewish women to dress in their fur coats. They gave them small brushes and forced them to scrub the streets. As a joke, acid was often put in the pails of water. Then, as the women knelt on the pavement, to the cheers and jeers of the large crowds of onlookers, Nazi soldiers urinated on their heads. It is somehow grotesquely appropriate that the city, which had a few years earlier produced a Weininger, who denied women their very existence, and had nourished the virulent misogyny and anti-Semitism of Hitler himself, should have witnessed the disgusting reality behind those fantasies. Nietzsche's Superman was revealed as bigoted beer hall bully. When the Nazi war machine swept through Poland and the Soviet Union 3 years later, genocidal acts became the norm. Huge numbers of Jewish men, women and children were rounded up and massacred. During the purges of the ghettos, before being massacred, Jewish men were usually stripped to the waist, left with what little dignity a pair of pants affords a man. Not so the Jewish women. They were more often than not stripped naked before being driven like cattle into the streets to be mocked and humiliated. We know this because German soldiers frequently took snapshots of these events, sometimes to send them to the folks back home, sometimes for the historical record. 2 grey, grainy pictures from the Polish ghetto of Mycosz, taken on the 14th of October 1942, show a line of 16 naked women huddled together, supervised by 2 soldiers. Heaps of clothes are piled or scattered on the short grass around them. There are 3 children among them, one a baby in its mother's arms, the other 2 little girls holding on to older women, probably their mothers or sisters. At a guess, the women range in age from their late 20s to their early 40s. Many cover their breasts in a futile attempt at protecting their modesty. They are obviously cold. They are being shunted down the line to death. The next grainy shot, taken minutes later, reveals a promiscuous pile of white bodies, and one woman, still alive, her back to the camera, raising herself up on her elbows next to the corpse of a little girl, while a German soldier stands over her, taking aim with a rifle, ready to finish her off. Such scenes were replayed again and again wherever the Nazis took power in the East. They were regarded as so normal that the soldiers involved in the killings felt happy to record them to share with their families, wives and girlfriends, as if they were vacation snaps. Even in the midst of the horrors of the concentration camps, Jewish women were frequently singled out for special treatment and subjected to grotesque gynecological experiments. In the concentration camp at Ravensbrück, Germany, Professor Karl Klauber carried out sterilization experiments on women. Using hundreds of Jewish and Gypsy women as guinea pigs, the notorious Nazi doctor Josef Mengele injected chemicals into the uterus to block their fallopian tubes. Younger women were forced into camp brothels set up for the sexual amusement of the guards. Public nakedness was used as a tool for their constant sexual humiliation. It was also used as a tool of elimination. In the death camp at Auschwitz, among new arrivals, women seen to be pregnant were directed to the left as they entered and shunted into the gas chambers. For Jewish women, the bearing of life had become a death sentence. To the very end in the Nazi scheme of inhumanity, where for the first time in history murder became an industrial process, misogyny still found a place. Unlike Nazism and other forms of fascism, socialism and the ideology that developed out of the ideas of Karl Marx were, from the beginning, very much on the side of women's emancipation. The goal of the Marxists was to eradicate differences, whereas the Nazis saw them as essential. Marxism's relation to misogyny is therefore a more complex one. In the 19th century, early socialists firmly supported women's rights. Marx and Friedrich Engels, 1820-95, produced scorching critiques of the position of women, which they saw as stemming directly from the development of a property-owning society. Patriarchy and women's oppression in this analysis is a direct result of property relationships. According to Engels, monogamous marriage comes on the scene as the subjugation of one sex by the other, and the relationship between man and woman provides a prototype for the class struggle, which Marxists saw as a driving force behind historical change. Woman's full emancipation could only come about when the property relations that underlay her subjugation were abolished. This, in turn, would only be achieved with a socialist revolution, the overthrow of capitalism and the bourgeoisie, and the triumph of the proletariat. It was another dualistic ideology in which, at least in the more simplistic versions that prevailed, the bourgeoisie represented corruption, greed, and decadence, and the proletariat, progress, freedom, and decency. History teaches us that women generally do not do well under dualistic ideologies in which the world is viewed as the battleground for two conflicting forces or principles. The philosophical framework for Marxist thought owes much to that of the 18th century empiricists. It shared their belief that social conditioning explains differences in people's characters and talents, including those found between classes, races, and genders. Woman's oppression was a problem of history rather than of biology, a problem which it should be the concern of historical materialism to analyze and revolutionary politics to solve. It accepted the blank slate hypothesis that consciousness was determined by social being. Marxists were confident that given the right economic circumstances, upon that slate they could draw a portrait of the new communist man and woman in whom the old divisions that so troubled human relationships over the centuries would no longer be evident. But where that left sexual differences was to prove problematic, especially if it were argued, as it would be, that social circumstances produced such differences and not nature. Nature had become a bourgeois and reactionary concept, one that was identified with those who wished to keep women enslaved. The opportunity to apply these beliefs first came in 1917 in Russia, when a demonstration during International Women's Day sparked off a series of political upheavals that within 6 months had led to the overthrow of the Tsar and the coming to power of the Bolsheviks led by Vladimir Lenin, 1870-1924. Lenin declared, "The proletariat cannot achieve complete freedom unless it achieves the complete freedom for women." The new government moved quickly on women's issues and within months of taking power passed legislation declaring the absolute equality of men and women. Women were granted the vote. They were given the right to divorce their husbands. In 1920, the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics, as the new state was called, legalized abortion, the first modern state to do so. By then, the Bolsheviks had become the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. In the belief that the only way woman would achieve freedom from what Lenin described as her daily sacrifice to 1,000 unimportant trivialities, she was to be liberated from the home and drafted into the large-scale socialist economy as a member of the proletariat. Since the home was identified with woman's slavery, it would be abolished. Large public dining halls, creches, communal kitchens and laundries were established to integrate the private world of the family into the world of the new social order. The despised bourgeoisie was identified with selfishness, luxury, and love of decoration. As usual in dualistic ideologies, anything associated with artifice, such as makeup, becomes demonized. In the new world order of communism, it was a symbol of what Lenin called the old bourgeois humiliation of women, a symbol of their sexual and domestic slavery from which Marxism had rescued them. In some ways, the Leninist utopia is similar to that of Plato's Republic, in which women were integrated into the ruling community as guardians only at the cost of denying important aspects of human sexuality, such as the love of beauty. In the aftermath of the Second World War, Soviet troops imposed the political, social, and economic model established in the Soviet Union on Eastern Europe. Mao Zedong, 1893-1976, followed that model when the communists fought their way to power in China in 1949. Similar systems were established in North Korea and North Vietnam. Hundreds of millions of men and women effectively became the guinea pigs in the greatest experiment in social engineering of all time. Ironically, the egalitarian promise contained in communism and expressed in the term comrade that was theoretically applied to all, regardless of rank, became instead an ideological steamroller that attempted to reduce individuals to products of social engineering in which human nature played no role. Had Marx not declared that the real nature of man is the totality of social relations, Hitler had declared that the age of the individual was over. On this, the communists, his main ideological enemies, agreed with him. Of course, as in Plato's Republic, males and females had different biological functions and therefore anatomical differences, but these were regarded as relatively unimportant in terms of behavior and psychology. Any attempt on the part of women to highlight or draw attention to sexual differences was at best frowned upon, and at worst among the more fanatical regimes, punished as evidence of possessing vicious bourgeois tendencies. In Maoist China, during the Cultural Revolution, 1962-76 or so, women were forbidden to wear skirts, which were a sign of their sexual slavery, and forced into the same uniform-style clothing as men, a sort of boiler suit with a peaked cap. Makeup was strictly forbidden. Neighborhood committees, set up by the local Communist Party, policed their periods to make sure they were not trying to violate the strict limits placed on the size of their families, which allowed only one child per couple. Experimental drugs were used on female comrades to control their fertility in the name of revolutionary science. Needless to say, the great experiment to remodel human nature according to the dictates of Marxist social theory failed. After Mao's death in 1976, as soon as more liberal policies began to be tolerated, beauty parlors began to appear, and Chinese women flocked to them. By the late 1990s, a sexual revolution was sweeping China in reaction to the decades of repression. Bars with lap dancers and go-go dancers began to open. The Chinese say the Cultural Revolution is the father of the Sexual Revolution. In China, women were often forced to have abortions in order to keep the size of their families down to prescribed limits. Meanwhile, in the Soviet Union in 1936, just 16 years after abortion had been legalized, it was banned under Joseph Stalin. To say Stalin, like Hitler before him, was pro-life is perhaps to miss the point. What is more important is what both have in common with the Chinese communists, and indeed with today's so-called pro-life movement in the United States. They are all anti-choice, believing that a woman's right to control her own fertility must be subordinated to goals more important than any notions she may have of her autonomy. That in itself is a form of contempt. Both right-wing and left-wing forms of totalitarianism are in many ways so profoundly alike that their ideological differences are mostly irrelevant. Both set out to reverse the political and moral revolution of the Enlightenment, which for the first time in history enshrined the idea of the individual's autonomy, his right to liberty and to pursue happiness, rights that have gradually been extended also to women. The totalitarian assault on the Enlightenment is nowhere more clearly illustrated than in its utter disregard, indeed contempt, for the rights of the individual, and the horrifyingly brutal manner with which totalitarian states treat their citizens. "The extreme violence of totalitarian systems," wrote the novelist Vasily Grossman, "proved able to paralyze the human spirit throughout whole continents." It might be argued, as it has been in relation to the Holocaust, that considering the horrors inflicted upon both men and women who fall foul of these regimes, there is little point in distinguishing them in terms of the suffering that both endure. Inhuman acts, by their very nature, deny or ignore the humanity of their victims. However, there is always room for misogyny. Indeed, in such regimes, cruelty against women based on misogynistic feelings is often the norm. Women are frequently punished for their femininity and for performing their biological role as mothers. Through its systematic mistreatment of women, the totalitarian state often reveals itself at its most frightening. In May 2002, a group of three defectors offered us a terrifying glimpse of life inside a women's prison in North Korea, part of a gulag of camps and jails, which currently is estimated to hold about 200,000 people. Human rights organizations believe that about 400,000 prisoners have died in custody there since 1972. The three defectors testified in May that year before the House International Relations Committee in Washington, D.C. They spoke about their experience as political prisoners in what is the last truly totalitarian state on Earth. Created in 1948 as the People's Democratic Republic of Korea, the country has been ruled by a sort of communist dynasty under Kim Il-sung and his successors since then. The defectors described how it was common practice to inject pregnant women with abortion-inducing shots. Guards and prison doctors forced mothers who gave birth in custody to either kill their babies themselves or watch as others killed them. One of the defectors, Sun Ok Lee, a 54-year-old economics researcher now living in Seoul, South Korea, has written a book about her time in prison, The Bright Eyes of the Tailless Beasts. She was held in Kaechon Political Prison, where, she said, 80% of the prisoners were housewives. She was one of 80 to 90 women held in a cell 19 feet long by 16 feet wide. They slept with no bedding on the floor. They were allowed to shower twice a year. They were permitted to go to the toilet twice a day, at fixed times, and in groups of 10. The special punishment cell was less than 2 feet wide and just over 3 feet high, too small to stand upright or to lie down and stretch your legs. If a woman was seen looking at her reflection in a window, she was punished for the bourgeois crime of vanity and sent to the dropout team for 3 months or 1 year. Their main job is to collect dung from the prison toilet tanks and dump it into a large dung pool for supply to the farming teams working at the prison farm outside the wall, Mrs. Lee told the committee. Two women wade knee-deep at the bottom of the toilet tank to fill a 20-litre rubber bucket with dung using their bare hands. Three other women pull up the rubber bucket from above and then pour the contents into a transport tank. The tank was then brought and emptied into a large dung pool. One rainy day in 1991, a housewife from Pyongyang, named Oktan Lee, who had been on the toilet detail all day, climbed onto the top of the tank when its lid became stuck. As she tried to force it open, she slipped from the rain-wet surface and plunged into the ground dung pool. It was so deep, she disappeared into the dung. A guard some distance away, they always keep their distance because of the stink from the prisoners, shouted, "Stop it! Let her die there unless you want to die the same way yourself." She was left to drown there in the dung. After recovering from a bout of paratyphoid in 1989, 2 years after she arrived in the prison, Mrs. Lee was told to report to the medical room. "When I arrived at the medical room, I noticed 6 pregnant women awaiting delivery," she said. "While I was there, 3 women delivered babies on the cement floor without any blankets. It was horrible to watch the prison doctor kicking the pregnant women with his boots. When a baby was born, the doctor shouted, "Kill it quickly! How can a criminal in the prison expect to have a baby? Kill it!" The women covered their faces with their hands and wept. Even though deliveries were forced by injection, the babies were still alive when born. The prisoner, stroke nurses, with trembling hands, squeezed the babies' necks to kill them. The babies, when killed, were wrapped in a dirty cloth, put into a bucket, and taken outside through a back door. I was so shocked with that scene that I still see the mothers weeping for their babies in my nightmares. I saw the baby killing twice while I was in the prison. Other defectors told the HIRC that on other occasions, the mothers themselves were forced to smother their babies with pieces of plastic after giving birth in their cells, and if they did not, the guards threatened to beat them. They said that there was special animosity towards women who had been made pregnant by Chinese men. Between March and May 2000, 8,000 North Korean defectors, most of them women, were deported from China back to their homeland as part of a crackdown on prostitution and forced marriage. Estimates are that up to one-third of them were pregnant. The vast majority of them were imprisoned on reaching North Korea. A former factory worker, identified only as Miss Lee, no relation to Mrs. Lee, told the HIRC, "The guards would scream at us, 'You are carrying Chinese sperm from foreign countries. We Koreans are one people. How dare you bring this foreign sperm here?'" Patriotic feelings about sperm may be thought of as a rather extreme example of nationalism, that mainly 20th-century phenomenon that has sparked so many wars and conflicts. But unfortunately, those wars and conflicts have taught us that it is not so unusual. Nationalism, one of the most divisive forces in history, overlaps with racism, religious sectarianism, and tribalism. At times, it has reached genocidal proportions, as it did in Rwanda in the spring of 1994. Women of the hated group are usually treated with a special contempt born out of misogyny and subjected to sexual tortures and rape before being murdered. In this dualistic vision of the world, the hated group represents the other, and the women of that group are usually seen as the most contemptible aspect of the perceived otherness, that is, its feminine form. The history of the last 100 years is a depressing chronicle of atrocities carried out under the influence of this intoxicatingly simple view of the world as being divided into us and them. From the rape of Nanking, then the capital of China, by the Japanese in December 1937, to the Hindu nationalist massacre of Muslims in Western India in March 2002, vulnerable women have suffered from the misogyny that always accompanies the racial or religious hatreds stirred up by nationalism. The grotesque mutilations that accompanied these attacks on women were of a sexual nature, so that it appeared as if ordinary men had been transformed into so many Jack the Rippers. Behaviour that would be normally seen as proof of psychosis became acceptable. Of course, war sanctions acts such as killing, of which society normally strongly disapproves. So in some sense, the Japanese soldiers and Hindu nationalists who gang-raped and then ripped open the wombs of pregnant Chinese and Muslim women to tear out their fetuses must have seen their behaviour as sanctioned. And it was, by the profound contempt for women enshrined at some deeper level in their cultures. The Japanese military used thousands of Korean women as comfort women during the war, a euphemism for forced prostitution. The soldiers' name for them was as direct as it was contemptuous. They were called toilets. In Nanking, no one knows the exact number of women raped, often as a prelude to being mutilated and murdered. But one figure puts it as high as 80,000. In actions reminiscent of serial killers of women such as Jack the Ripper, the Japanese left the bodies of their victims lying in the streets with their legs splayed open, their vaginas pierced with bamboo canes, sticks, bottles, and other objects. The Germans claimed that during the Soviet army's advance across East Prussia in 1945, all German women who stayed behind were raped by Red Army soldiers. One Soviet tank officer later boasted, 2 million of our children were born in Germany. If true, This would make the Soviet invasion of Germany the occasion of the biggest mass rape in history. Rape in war is as old as war itself, both as a way of taking revenge on the enemy population and as sexual relief for frustrated soldiers. But in the civil wars that followed the breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s, it acquired a sinister dimension. It became a weapon of ethnic conflict as the Serbian majority launched attacks on the Croat and Muslim minorities. During 1992, Serbian authorities established rape camps where Muslim and Croatian women were systematically raped and impregnated. The Serbian Orthodox Church taught for years that the Serbs' low birth rate was because Serbian women were selfish. They declared it a sin against the Serbian race. Propagandists warned the Serbs that fundamentalist Muslims were kidnapping healthy Serbian women between the ages of 17 and 40 to be impregnated by Orthodox Islamic seed. The Serbs believed, as did Muslims and Croatian Catholics, that it was the male who determined the child's identity, with the female playing no more than the role of incubator to his seed. As we have seen, this misogynistic fantasy goes back to Aristotle. The Serbs therefore saw forced impregnation as a means of reproducing the ethnic group. At the same time, it was a means of profoundly humiliating their enemies, especially the Muslims, who have a saying, "As our women are, so also is our community." Therefore, these unfortunate women were made to carry a double burden, which made their bitter personal humiliation also a devastating humiliation for their community. Their families and husbands often rejected those women who survived the rapes. The all-too-familiar identification of a woman's virtue with the honour of the family or nation or race always means that women are punished twice over for acts over which they have no control. To the trauma of rape is added the trauma of communal rejection. Many women went mad, and some committed suicide. It is not known exactly how many women suffered sexual violence at the hands of the Serbs. Figures vary from between 20,000 and 80,000. The wars in the former Yugoslavia brought up the whole question of rape as a war crime. Traditionally, rape in wartime is the least punished offence, and women began campaigning to redress this injustice. In 1993, at the UN Conference on Human Rights held in Vienna, rape and other forms of sexual violence were recognised as war crimes. Further conferences in Beijing and Cairo, which addressed the issue in the context of women's rights in general, reiterated the declaration, though not without considerable opposition on some issues from representatives of the Vatican and Muslim states. Undoubtedly, this represents a moral advance, but its practical effects will almost certainly be limited. The problem is the nature of war itself, in which the most important moral prohibition of all, that against killing fellow human beings, is removed. Never was this more emphatically the case than in the total wars fought in the 20th century, which saw the near extermination of entire communities, and not only at the hands of Nazis and communists. Between 1943 and 1945, Allied bombers systematically obliterated German cities, killing about 700,000 men, women and children. When such monstrous violations of ordinary human decency are accepted as legitimate, then it should not be surprising if rape is ignored. Realistically, the only way to abolish rape during war is to abolish war itself. As we move into the second millennium, that seems extremely unlikely. Indeed, with the rise of nationalism and other dualistic ideologies which dehumanize the hated group on racial, ethnic, or religious lines, rape and the sexual degradation of women, if anything, would seem to be encouraged.